Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And by the way, thank you for making our winter membership drive such a great success. We raised over $915,000 for more than 7,900 members to help pay for programs like this one. We also welcome almost 2,000 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. So thank you very much for supporting us here at WPR. And we'll get right to our programming. That's what it's all about. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our computer consultant who comes by every month, as a matter of fact, to talk with us about your personal computer problems. Questions for him, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email talk at WPR.org. Pete, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry.
Got some new things. We got a service pack out there for Microsoft.
Let's see. Windows 7 service pack and Server 2008 service pack came out February 22nd. Although, going to their download page and trying to understand what you're supposed to choose, just read the fine print at the very bottom of the page, which will explain
should have been explained on the top of the page.
Right, which file you need. Or you could do updates from your system, and it'll tell you which one you need. But regardless, someone's reviewed that, and basically, and I would agree, it's called Slim Pickings instead of for Service Pack. That's what the SP stands for. They got it right when they came out with it, so there really aren't any major upgrades to it. Something worth noting is that after you apply the Service Pack, they still released other fixes after the 22nd or on the 22nd, so if you keep checking updates, even after you applied the service pack, it'll still tell you that there are other updates to apply. When you do it, it tells you it may take an hour or more on your computer. And again, that depends upon the hardware. Systems that I were working on that are more current, I would say it's a roughly, plus or minus a 20, maybe 25-minute procedure. Pretty painless. Nothing that I saw that was anything worth noting. Just read the screens and pay attention. Creating a restore point, it does it on its own, but that's always a good thing. So make sure you have system restore turned on your system. And then Apple on March 2nd announced iPad 2.
Mm-hmm.
A little thinner. Same battery life, same memory configurations, added a couple of cameras, things that were anticipated. Looks like they're leapfrogging the competition again, which I would have to agree with Jobs and his comment in the press release, is that, all these tablets are supposed to be coming out this year, roughly somewhere over 100 tablets. Whether or not it's supporting Google's Droid operating system. And for those that don't know, Droid was an operating system was acquired by Google a number of years ago, and that's why it's got Google's name on it. So there's a new Droid operating system for the newer tablets. The point being is that, Apple just keeps pushing the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And the competition, the price point that Apple has set on their iPads is $499, $599, $699 with just the Wi-Fi. So if you're traveling and you go to hotels that have Wi-Fi, you have access to using the internet for, web browsing, email, and so forth. And then the ones that are 3G enabled, you have to go through a service, but, you can use it that way when you're traveling. My point is that in the next probably 3 to 5 years, they used to talk about how we have, we went to multi-computer families. We had the one computer in the family,
right.
And now we have multiple computers. It's going to be multiple tablets because most people are looking at browsing the web, email, Facebook access. Again, that's internet, web, chatting, doing some minimum, composing of letters. And the convenience of it being light, easy to turn on, ready to go when you need it, travelability,
yeah,
it's
tremendous.
You know, just, you know, they're going to be put on counters and bathrooms and, but, you know, the price point on some of the competitive tablets with features and stuff is just, you know, it's not where Apple's raised the bar. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the other competitive products and how they readjust their pricing to get, you know, more market share. Because 15 to 16 million of those sold in the first year with the first generation. So it'll be interesting to see this time next year what the numbers look like in terms of tablet sales, not only for Apple, but, you know, the whole market
everybody
in general.
Else. Yeah, absolutely. Barb in Oconomowoc has a question for you. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I greatly enjoyed your panel at the Garden Expo. I was there.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Now, my question, can getting a virus on my laptop is what I have, completely knock me offline? I cannot get back online at all?
Yes, it can.
Okay.
All right. There's a couple of things you can do. When you get a system that's infected with a virus, sometimes, and this doesn't always work, but you might be able to go to System Restore and go back and, you know, use a restore point, excuse me, that goes prior to when you were experiencing the problem. Sometimes the viruses knock that feature out where you can't do that. So in the case of that, what you need to do is probably get access to either a CD or a DVD that's had an antivirus program burned onto it that's recent, and then run that while your system is disconnected from the internet, as you probably can't, like you said, you can't get on, and see if the current antivirus software can knock that out. The other thing is, some of them kind of tell you what they are. You might be able to find, you know, if you run an antivirus program and it tells you what the virus is, but it can't do anything about it, you might be able to go online with another system to do some research to see if there's like an actual removal tool to get rid of it, to find out where it is. The real bad ones morph. In other words, they know that you're chasing after it. So it morphs itself into a different name or a different file on your system. So and that's what these antivirus programs try to do, is prevent them from infiltrating your system. None of them are 100%, because there's always those ones that get through that now tell the rest of the world there's another virus out there that's infecting people. So trying to keep an antivirus program on your system updated as often as possible is the best preventive maintenance medicine you can do for your system, but it's not 100% guarantee. The other thing is, if you're able to get online with another system and go to infostar.com, and on the left-hand side, go to the tips page, and the very last tip, I have instructions about how to try and remove the really stubborn viruses that get caught, that seem to occupy the memory in your system, and you're able to identify them, and there are some tools that allow you to actually go and zap them. It's called File Assassin in one of the programs. So it allows you to actually go there, locate the file, and delete it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I will try that.
All right.
Thank you very much. It's a mystery to me.
Yeah, I would always, in the System Restore, which version of Windows are you using? XP, Vista?
Windows XP.
Windows XP. If you go to Accessories, so you click on the Start button, go to... where it says Programs, find Accessories, and then in Accessories, find System Tools, and then in System Tools, look for System Restore, and that's where, you know, if you're going to have a restore point, if it hasn't been turned off by the virus or if it hasn't been disabled, you should be able to go back prior to when you were having the problem, pick a date, and then just do the system restore and see if that works.
Okay, great.
And then make sure if that happens to work, then I would get an antivirus program. You can download them online. I don't know, you know, if it's something that you feel comfortable doing, but if you go to the Virus Info Center page and look for AV Help, I have a whole bunch of links there that are for different antivirus programs that don't cost anything, but you do have to download them. So mm-hmm. you do have to have access to the internet.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Barbara. Mary in the town of Lisbon wondered just on the same thing, if you could get a virus from a public Wi-Fi connection.
A virus from a public Wi-Fi? Well, the public Wi-Fi in and of itself is not going to be dishing out you know, viruses. You have to link up to something. In other words, you have to, you know, it's not seeding out to connections. So if you're going to, there are some sites that have malicious ActiveX enabled components to the website that mm-hmm. could infiltrate your system. But again, you have to go to grab something. It's not seeding. It's not pushing out a virus.
Okay.
That would be kind of crazy. You know, I mean, that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to replicate itself, you know, mm-hmm. by getting two recipients. But usually the recipient is either bringing it in typically by email and then clicking on an attachment, which then runs on your system, and then you get the virus. That's a typical way.
Let's go to Terry in Madison next. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Larry. I always enjoy this program. I always learn something.
Thank you.
Even when I'm not in the mood for a computer. So I have several antivirus programs on my computer, and I'm wondering if they're interacting, because my computer has gotten very slow over a while, and nothing seems to cure it, no matter what I do.
Which ones are you using?
I have Malwarebytes Anti-Malware, which the university DoIt put on for me,
sure.
And I like
yep.
it.
And that's the program that's got the file assassin in the tools section. So if you ever have to delete a stubborn file, you can point to a file and it'll zap it right off your computer.
Okay, good. Then there's McAfee Security Scan Plus that mm-hmm. came with something. Windows Defender, which I dislike but can't get rid of. naturally. Norton Security Scan.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and the Symantec Endpoint Protection. I don't know how these things came on here. The Symantec probably came with the computer.
Yeah. Which version of the operating system are you using?
I'm running Vista on an HP Pavilion.
Oh, boy.
Sorry.
Well, the reason I say, oh, boy, is, you know, Microsoft should just be giving Windows 7 to all the Vista users, because...
Well, it did, but I like Vista.
Windows 7 is just more stable, better operating system than Vista tries to be. Okay. The Malwarebytes is not an issue. The McAfee and Norton... and Windows Defender. Windows Defender likes to touch everything. So, you know, in a single user environment, Windows Defender is probably enough. McAfee and Norton just like to be in control. And, yeah, they could be fighting each other.
Okay, so, I'll get rid of those.
So I would probably... You know, just uninstall those two and stick with the Windows Defender. You could also, if you wanted to, if it's Windows Defender, but the current version is called Microsoft Security Essentials.
Yes, I've got that. That's really what I've got.
Yeah, so Windows Defender is kind of like a subset of that.
Right, yeah.
Yep.
So can I keep the Symantec Endpoint Protection?
I would probably take that off, too.
Oh, okay.
And if you run it in the safe mode, you know, they have their uninstalls. So follow through with their uninstalls and see if that works. The other thing that you might want to download that will clean up your registry and help speed up your system is a program called CCleaner. So if you just do a search with any search engine, C and then cleaner, C-L-E-A-N-E-R.
Okay, so it's two C's and then
yep.
cleaner. Okay.
Yep, mm-hmm. It's called, it's by a company called Puriform, if I pronounce that correctly. And then if you look, there's a free link in the kind of fine print underneath. You'll see it says either File Hippo or by Puriform. You know where to do the download. If you do it from their site, you won't get bugged. And if you download, it's fairly small file as far as downloads go. I think about 3 meg.
Okay.
And if you run the registry cleaner, I usually back it up the first time when it prompts you to back it up. And then I run it probably about 3 times to just make sure that all the entries are cleaned, and then reboot your machine and it'll probably run a lot better.
I will do that. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yep. And also, I would create multiple restore points on mm-hmm. your system as you do things, just in case things start going awry, especially with Norton and McAfee, because they just infiltrate systems. They just really like to be in control.
I'd get rid of them.
Yeah.
I would.
The other interesting part of this conversation is Norton and McAfee are typically targets of the viruses. So when and if you do get one, they really wreak havoc on a system that has those on there, because they just go, oh, we got our hooks in, and then they just start, because Norton and McAfee have their hooks in everything else, it really starts to make things go bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because they have targets, because they're on so many systems.
Yep.
You know, if something happens, you don't keep it updated and something happens to get through, then they're like, oh,
then
we got one.
You
know,
it's
like hooking a big fish.
There you go, Terry. Thanks a lot for calling. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant, Larry Mueller here. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we talk about your personal computer with Peter Green. Thanks for listening. Call us at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Patrick now in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Is this Larry?
Yeah.
Oh, outstanding. You cannot imagine how long I've waited to get on this radio program of yours. all my life, basically. I got a question, two quick questions for Peter.
Okay.
I prefer to ask him in person, but I'm not going to be in Madison this week, and I don't know where he lives anymore. So, the first one, I was at a rally here in La Crosse. I dealt with collective bargaining issues, and that's a small issue we got going on here in the La Crosse area, and among the teachers, anyway. And so I had recorded everyone I talked to, in a WMA audio file. And what I need to do is get some comments to either you at WPR or NPR, but the file's too big to email. I need the most basic program, and I'm not mixing anything for the next Michael Jackson album or anything. I just want to be able to cut a chunk of this out of the center so I can email it to somebody.
Okay.
And I've looked at CNET. Mm-hmm. I downloaded their top 2 recommended programs.
Okay.
All that did was take over command of my Internet Explorer and then tell me where to go.
Uh-huh.
And so I was wondering if there's something more basic that maybe was created around Windows 95 that I may be able to use in my Windows 7 Dell.
So you're using Windows 7?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, and then my second... Well, this will be the third question, but does a Dell computer make a good boat anchor for the spring walleye run in the Mississippi?
depends on which one. I know they've had some recalls or issues with capacitors and seeing those burn out. So
I may find out firsthand, and I'll call you back and let you know for sure.
Well, you know, there was a lawsuit against them, so you know you could probably check with your model online and see if you're part of that.
I think I must have cut off on that by 2 days.
Uh-huh. Okay, there are programs that allow you to edit sound files.
Yeah.
So, you know, that really shouldn't be an issue. And I know there are a lot of good ones out there that you should be able to find, you know, by CNET site, their download.com.
Been there.
And, you know, you just, you know, look for, you know, sound or audio editing. you know, and put in WMA file type, you know, and
one really simple one is Audacity.
You know, you can download ones that have, you know, trial versions usually let you, you know, work with stuff. But the other thing that you might want to consider doing is rather than emailing, because emailing a large file, even zipping a large file, can still become a large file. You know, in other words, you go from a large file to still what's considered a large file because there might be screens or filters that say, hey, that file was too big. You know, we're not going to let it come through our system. Is on my top 10 websites, I know I've got listed sites for sharing or collaborating on documents and just files in general. Office Live, I think that, what is their Skybox or something like that is one of their products. But I've got a link in my top 10 for this month that gives you like three different sites for posting files online. So you should be able to, you know, post the file online and you're trying to share it with somebody so you can use it to collaborate, you know, and get that file over to someone else. And, you know, if you get it over here, they'll be able to edit it too. So you just tell them what, you know, what you're trying to get to them and give them some reference points and, you know, they'll be able to listen to the file.
Yeah, well, so I
wouldn't really straight, you know, if you're new to doing that and you don't feel comfortable, you may, you know, may want to just kind of hand it off and let someone else work with it.
I've got something called, we have a free audio system is Audacity.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you got that one. Yeah, and you found that hard to use?
And that one and the next one. Well, you got to understand, I'd been up at 6 a.m. on Saturday in a long day. Yeah. And the timeliness of this news cycle and the people that have the power to put stuff out with a .org name behind it and make themselves legitimate and then have them cut pieces from discussions that went on that totally misrepresent the truth.
Yeah. So I see your problems. I see your problems. Well, Pete, I think you had some good advice.
Yeah, I've used those programs to slice and dice audio files, and they're all out there. It's just trying to shotgun learn something real fast can be frustrating if you're just missing a small part of the program. You know what the other thing you might want to do is I found this very helpful is go to YouTube and do a search on what you're looking for and see if someone posts a little tutorial on how to use a certain program to do what you're trying to do. Because I use that for learning software all the time.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good tutorials that are posted on YouTube.
There's a good one on Audacity, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There you go, Patrick. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, I want to give Dan and Madison a chance here. Dan, hello to you.
Talking about Facebook, my wife just got an account, and when she tries to play a video, it keeps on, stopping and starting all the time. Now, I tried updating Adobe Flash Player, but that does not help. It kind of, you know.
Does it do it on everything?
Pretty much every video. You know, it'll go for 5 seconds, and then it'll time out, and it'll want to catch up.
Okay. What you may want to check is see if the device drivers on your system are updated.
Okay.
I would go into which version of the operating system are you using?
Windows 7.
Windows 7. If you go into Windows 7 control panel and try to remember which icon. They do large icons. They do small icons. I would check in I believe they still have device management. I look at this stuff so often that I sometimes it doesn't, you know, the names don't exactly come to me. But I think it might be device manager, device settings. If you go in there and take a look at your the video card and also your multimedia sound. Can affect that as well and make sure those are updated. The other thing is, if you know the manufacturers of your video card, you may want to go specifically to their website and see if you can download the latest device drivers for the card through them. Sometimes you have to even do a reinstall to just make sure that there's not a problem with it.
Yeah. Okay.
The reason it's cutting off is something's creating a roadblock. So one of the first things to do is, okay, the roadblock is the video. So because it's not playing, is it something to do with the computer communicating with your video card and memory? And that's what the device drivers, that's how they function.
Okay.
So that's one thing to check.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Another tool to use, and I'm trying to remember if it's still current or what they've done with it, but Microsoft put up a almost like a troubleshooting toolkit. I'm trying to remember what they called it, but you could probably do a search on Microsoft Windows 7 troubleshooting tool and see if there's a Microsoft link up there for that it interacts with your computer. I know I've got a link to it somewhere on my system, but I'll have to look at through at one of the breaks and see if I can come up with that name again. A lot of names to things out there.
Here's one. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to. Dennis in Loves Park has a question for you. It seems that IPv4 is being replaced by IPv6.
Yep.
Which allows for many more internet addresses. Is using IPv6 optional, or are the IPv4 users just behind the times in not upgrading?
There's typically, you know, with Windows 7, you see this. I don't even remember if they had it in Vista, but I know in Windows 7 installs, it's there. I typically turn it off. In other words, I was working on stuff this weekend, and I just turn it off, and it may or may not create some interference on your system. I do not believe it's being used at this point in time. It's
okay.
Kind of like a standard that's been put out there, but typically the networking stuff that people are using today is still using IPv4, which stands for Internet Protocol Version 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the 6, yeah, it does allow for more addresses, but I don't know who's using it.
Email from Pat is use of the iPad covered, the cost of the iPad covered under the fee already paid to your internet provider, or is there a separate charge? If a separate charge, what's the monthly fee?
Oh, for the iPad?
Yeah.
Well, there's two models of the iPad.
Yeah.
The Wi-Fi version. And then the one that's the 3G or 4G, you know, wherever that's going for the Wi-Fi service, which is what you have to pay for. So a Wi-Fi-enabled device that doesn't have 3G or 4G attached to it, a Wi-Fi-enabled device, whether it's an iPad or a smartphone or a computer or laptop, does not pay an extra fee to get onto the internet, as long as they're in range to receive the Wi-Fi signal and they're allowed to get access to that Wi-Fi signal. If you need a if you go to an airport and you have a Wi-Fi enabled device, it's going to see that airport Wi-Fi and you can get to it if you pay them.
Yeah.
But if you have a Wi-Fi-enabled device that has 3G or 4G service, you're going to get it through that nationwide service because you're paying for access to that service wherever you are, wherever you use that device. If you use that device now to create an access point for other people to access you, those people would get onto your system giving you permission. You know, you're giving them permission. They would not be paying because they're going through your link. So the point of this whole thing is if you have Wi-Fi-enabled devices, as long as you have access to the Wi-Fi, you're not being charged extra for it. If you have the 3G or 4G Wi-Fi service, you're paying extra for that. Those are their monthly charges, and they're metered. I know AT&T used to charge like unlimited data, but really people would say, yeah, it's limited at like five meg download. You know, it's not really unlimited, and they monitor it. But typically they're going to a metered rate, so you may charge you like 15 for 2 megs of download, and you pay extra for anything above that. So,
Wi-Fi, if you have the iPad with the Wi-Fi, you can rent, like say if you're going away from home,
right?
You can get on a network for a month.
You could go to a place that has access points, and you could rent, you know, if you needed to rent access, you could, you know, pay for that. Just like in an airport, yeah. You know, for that day, you could pay to have access to the Wi-Fi, you know, so you're paying for it piecemeal and not, you know, every month seeing a charge.
But you can do it for a month.
When you say for a month, how are you, if you go to another...
Yeah, if you're going somewhere else where you don't have your own Wi-Fi,
you
should be able to rent through it, like AT&T, for example.
Yeah, but you would have to have the model that supported that. See, in other words, they identify you through SIM technology.
Right.
So you would have to have the model that supports that to allow you to turn it on. And I don't know if they have monthly plans.
Yeah, they
do. If they do have monthly plans... you'd still have to have that system, that device that supports access to their network.
Yeah.
So it's not just the Wi-Fi component, it's also the 3G, 4G component.
Yeah.
So if you don't have that in your device, then you can't rent it because your device is not capable of doing that.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Leslie in Cottage Grove, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello. Nice to talk with you.
Good to talk to you. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a computer that perhaps it's a bit rickety, but I keep keeping it moving along. It's a 2004 gamers-type PC that I put together, and the issue is that the drive that I got with it as a bootable drive, which is a Western Digital, nice and fast, 10,000 RPM, but it's only 36 gig. It is stuffed. My young teenagers were on it. God knows what's on the drive. I've been keeping it, everything, antivirus and all that stuff. But that drive is stuffed, so I bought a 1 terabyte Seagate internal to put in that, and I had one heck of a time getting it hooked up under XP. I had many geek friends come over to finally get that thing working. So if I upgrade the machine to Windows 7... I hear I will have less trouble. I can clean off that 36-gig drive. I need to be able to reconnect to the 1 terabyte, and I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to do that. Should Win 7 automatically recognize all the drives that were created under XP? Am I going to have trouble upgrading here?
Wow. how much RAM do you have in your computer?
At least a gig.
At least a gig.
If that's an issue, I'll get it more. Now, it was bought 2004, so maybe the answer you're going to tell me that would really solve the problem, that might be an answer, too. But so far, I've been keeping the 2004 machine going along just fine.
Yeah. Well, what happens when you start looking at upgrading operating systems, a lot of your 2004 is pre-Vista, pre-Windows 7. You may have an issue with video RAM. I would say at least 2 gigs of RAM to me would be a minimum for Windows 7 configuration. You start running into issues with device drivers for your hardware being compatible with Windows 7. So there may be some system board support issues, some video support issues. In other words, the manufacturer would have had to make an attempt to upgrade support for your hardware to support the new operating system.
So even if I'm doing things like flashing the BIOS and going out there occasionally and looking for updated device drivers, there may be some other problems, such as it's a 2004 motherboard.
Correct. Yeah, because they may have not gone, you know, done the support to move forward with the newer operating system.
Okay.
When I redid my son's HP laptop, it was at a point in time where Vista came out, but I went and found support drivers for XP because he got frustrated with Vista, so I went back to XP. But I had to make sure I could find the device drivers to support the hardware, so because it was a newer system, which means I was going backwards. So it's always important when you redo a system to do the research to making sure you have the support for all the devices for the operating system you're choosing to use.
So even if I've done things such as upgraded the video card and
may not necessarily be, you need to make sure you identify everything in your system. And there are tools out there. There's Belarc Advisor, B-E-L-A-R-C, Advisor. And then Piriform has a tool called S-P-E-C-C-Y. So if you do a search on that, both of those you can download for free, and they'll tell you what you have in your system. And then, you know, do the research if you've got documentation, you know, but just make sure you have all the device drivers for the operating system. In this case, you want to do it with Windows 7. Now, the other thing is support for the hard drive. Probably with that system board should not be an issue. Although, what's the interface between the hard drive that you, the new Seagate, are you using SATA?
That's what, I believe so. That's what it says on the box.
So is it an internal or an external?
Internal.
Well, that's good, because that's fast. So that should be okay. But it's the other components that I just...
Just
a little concerned about and the memory being the 1 gig instead of 2, and the video card. The video might be another issue, too.
Yeah, there you go. Lots to check on, Leslie.
I can tell you from experience, and I don't know what your budget is, but I buy a lot of systems off of eBay because you can save a lot of money. excuse me. As long as you're comfortable with having something shipped to you. I'll give you an example. What I do is typically go to, there's a like CPU benchmark, or you can look for CPU benchmarks to see what the processor speeds are like and how much the wholesale price is on a CPU. So you can gauge how much you can invest in the CPU. And I usually look for something that's got 4 gigs of RAM when I'm putting in a new system. And the hard drives they usually include are, you know, you can get bare bones, but it's like, why do you want to do all this extra work? So you can get like 4 gigs of RAM and a 500 gig hard drive or a 1 terabyte hard drive. They tell you the specs on it. You can even get a solid state drive if you want. And those come in different price ranges. But my point is you can get... a very fast quad-core processor system with 4 gigs of memory to 8 gigs of memory running 32 or 64-bit Windows 7, 500 to 1 terabyte hard drive without the operating system for under $500 shipped to you.
Yeah.
So you need, you know, you can still use your monitor. You could still use your keyboard. Some of them include the keyboard. They include a cheap mouse. Optical mouse, no more roller. So my point is you can save a lot of money if you're okay doing it that way. And you say, well, how do I know I'm going to get what I'm ordering? If you look at the sellers that are selling those kind of systems online, eBay has a feedback system. And I'm not saying this is for everybody, but some of these sellers have 100% feedback for, you know, 15,000 transactions.
Yeah.
They're delivering what they're selling.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, going to a store or, you know, having someone else ship you something that's not in the store but is going to show up at your doorstep. And even Apple sells their iPad that way. You go to the Apple online and they, you know, they'll deliver it to you by FedEx.
Yeah.
So
there you go. Good luck, Leslie. Thanks for calling. Peter Green of InfoStar Madison, our personal computer consultant. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Green, our guest today as we talk computers with him.
I want to make one comment. The other thing is when you start tinkering with systems, mm-hmm. you start to upset the equilibrium, you know,
right.
the computer's working and all of a sudden you got your fingers in there and doing stuff. Occasionally, you may short something out, get a power supply issue. Power supplies, you got to find a replacement power supply. And those can be a $100 item. They used to be less expensive when we had some of the retailers like CompUSA, you know, in business, but, you know, that place went under. My point is that when you start tinkering with systems, you can have other issues brought in, not just you're trying to upgrade or add something, but if you're not careful with, you know, making sure if you're opening up the computer, you're working in your socks, you're touching the power supply, it's unplugged, so that you dissipate the electricity and being safe so that you don't, you know, cause other issues. And all of a sudden it's like, why is this thing beeping at me? Why is it beeping 8 times? You know, why is there Morse code coming from the machine?
Oh, boy. Walt wants to know, what's a good free backup program for Windows 7? I have a network-attached hard drive.
Couple of good ones. I would recommend using a program called Yadis, Y-A-D-I-S. It's a free download. It's got file versioning, which means that you can enable, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Mm-hmm. You can specify how many you want. You create your backup sets, and anytime something changes, it'll send it to the target drive, which in this case you're calling a network attached storage or NAS, and you know, just make sure you point to it, and it'll do it. There's another one, I think it's called GFI. That's a little bit more sophisticated, but it does have security components to it and password protection that Yadis does not have.
Okay.
And Yadis is a very small program, and you know, it's like I think less than a 2 meg download, and you know, just search for that, and it's really easy to use, and it even asks you, are you a beginner or an expert, and you know, it's very easy to use.
Marvin in Menominee, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Say, I'm calling him. I have an XP PC that I run, and it used to be when I'd look in System Restore, there would be a number of restore dates set up that I could pick from, and the other day I had to go and do a restore, and there's only one, and that was the one that was set up by the system that morning, like at 6:30 in the morning, and I restored using that one, but you know, I couldn't find any other ones, and I added another program that day, and I set a new restore point, and the next day I went in and looked, and it was no longer there, and there was just the one from that next morning. How do I get back to having multiple restore points?
I'm wondering if you...
Am I running out of room on my...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, and it's maybe just, you know, rewriting the area that it's got allocated for it. So I would check and take a look at your hard drive space. Maybe you have to do a, you know, like reinitiate your system restore. In XP, if you go into the system restore screen, you can, usually there's a link to click on for the settings and see how much of the hard drive space is being used. Mm-hmm. The default is usually 12%. But you should also check and see how much hard drive storage you have and see, you know, if that's an issue, because you're saying it's XP, which is typically an older system.
Yeah.
Is check and see how much space you have on your hard drive left. Another way to gain some space is if you right mouse click on your recycle bin and click on properties and resize that down from the default of 10% to 1%.
Oh, okay.
That'll free up space.
Yeah, I know it's kind of a smaller drive, probably only 320 megabytes or something. And I have a bunch of remote drives that I've been, like, putting all my pictures and everything on.
Uh-huh.
Because I did almost run out of room there one time. But.
Yeah, so I would resize the recycle bin. And also, if you use a program like CCleaner, which does work on XP, it can clean up and remove a lot of files that, you know, might be redundant or temporary that might help free up some more space that you're not even aware of that you're, you know, you're using.
C cleaner.
So it's C and then cleaner.
Okay.
And all a company's right. called
CC Leaner.
Yeah. CC Leaner. Yeah. Yep.
That's great. And then one quick question then about network storage devices. Uh-huh. I have a network in my home.
Yeah.
And are they pretty much plug and play? Boom, it's there when you plug it into your router.
Relatively speaking, I mean they're pretty good about directions. D-Link makes a DNS 321, which can be had for under $100 typically, and you can add any size hard drives you want to them, and their instructions prepare the drives for network attached storage, and you can do a lot of different things with them. You can, you know, I would do a review, check for reviews on network attached storage, and you might want to start with going to like CNET and typing in DNS -321 by D-Link and see what the editor choices are and the different sizes. That gives you two bays to add drives to, and you can put in whatever SATA drive you want to put in there. So you can put in 500 meg drives, put 1 terabyte drives, 2 terabyte drives.
Mm-hmm. How about the wireless network backup drives? Have you heard any good about that?
The thing about the wireless network drives is the connection's typically not as fast as the hardwired one.
Oh, sure.
So that's where you may have an issue in terms of speed and moving, you know, large file types. Typically, when people are doing backups or copying, you can use it. These network attached storage devices, not only for backups but for extra storage, is they usually like to have some speed.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, the DNS 321, and there's the next one up, which has like a print server feature, mm-hmm. which you may or may not need. But my point is that typically they say they're rated for gigabit throughput, but they're probably not quite that fast.
Okay.
But if you have a router that doesn't have a gigabit switch, it doesn't mean anything because you're just going to connect up at 100 meg throughput anyhow.
Right.
You have to have a router with a gigabit switch that allows you to connect at that speed.
I don't think I have one.
Yeah.
There you go.
Now, you bring up, you know, networking and Windows XP. I'm just going to bring this out there. Microsoft does not acknowledge this problem as that it being a bug, but it is a bug. And, you know, how do I get through to them? I get through to them by, if they're listening to the radio show and they hear me calling, I'm telling them it's a bug. If you have a Windows 7 machine and you're trying to link to it with a Windows XP machine, if the link hookup goes away, in other words, the Windows XP machine can no longer see the Windows 7 machine and you're trying to grab files from it, it's because of this bug. And you could reboot your Windows XP machine as many times as you want until you're green, blue, purple, and it won't work. The Windows 7 machine has to be rebooted in order for the XP machine to gain access to it again. Has something to do with permissions, and I've seen some fixes attempted to change things, but it's not, it's a bug. So I'm just making people aware that if you've been frustrated with an XP machine trying to link up with a Windows 7 and you reboot it and go, why isn't this working? Why isn't this working? It's the Windows 7 machine that has to be rebooted.
There you go. So. Thanks a lot for calling, Mark. Appreciate it. And Clyde in Denmark?
Good morning.
Hi.
I have Windows XP on a laptop. I have questions in three areas. The first two are pretty quick, and the third one I'm not sure. First one is on the C cleaner thing. I heard you a couple months ago on that, so I tried to download it, and what I got wasn't C cleaner, it's PC cleaner. And so that's what I had Googled, and I thought I was Googling the right thing, but now it's on my machine, and it wants to charge me $25, and I can't get rid of it. But anyway, so I'll try the C cleaner and see if I can find that. It said that the PC cleaner. It said it was a free thing when I clicked on it, and it isn't.
Yep.
Okay, the second is, if you're going to put two antivirus-free programs on, what would be the best two?
Okay.
I would probably AVG and Avast.
AVG.
And AVAST.
AVAST. Mm-hmm. And AVG.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The third one is, my computer has been infected by somebody that is sending my email lists, unsolicited emails, supposedly mm-hmm. from me, but they aren't from me.
Right.
Yeah.
And how do I take care of that?
That is a question that we will ponder for a minute. There are a lot of people who have that same issue, believe me, Clyde. And Peter will think about that, and we'll talk about it right after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your personal computer today with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. We have lots of questions to get to, but this time of the show, we always take a look at what's out there, in, at least in Peter's mind, for a list of great places to visit online. He's got a top 10 list for us, and what have you got for us today?
Okay, if you go to InfoStar.com, click on Top 10 Archives, scroll to today's date, or click on Current Top 10. They're all there, if I pronounce them all correctly. Radio, R-E-A-D-E-O.com. The person that came up with this idea, it's a way of book chatting online.
Hmm.
So it's just, you know, really working with your kids and your grandparents and, you know,
yeah,
covering distances. So it's an interesting thing to look at. Number two is called phplist.com. Excuse me. It's an open source email campaign manager, and it's free. Number three, and I put on here a note, it's not a guarantee to solve incompatible devices that work with Adobe Flash, but it's worth looking at, and it's called skyfire.com. Number four is commerceconnect.gov, and it's a one-stop shop to help businesses around the country transform themselves into globally competitive enterprises. Number five, and I mentioned that I had links to collaborative sites for
right.
documents and files and things like that. So this one is called iCloud.com. And there's SlideShare, Google Docs, and Office Live. So there's multiple places to put stuff up there in the cloud. Number six is pretty much an airline safety and security information resource, and it's called airsafe.com. And they've got like a top 10 baggage tips for airline passengers and things like that. Number seven is another web content management system called, I believe it's pronounced Umbraco, UMBRACO.com. Number eight, a social networking community for teens where you can share your writing, connect with other readers, and discover new stories and authors, and it's called Figment, FIGMENT.com. Number nine, excuse me, is by an author named Richard Geller, and it's just a very interesting, entertaining, interactive multimedia website. That's the best way I can describe it. And it's called A Site About Something. A-S-I-T-E About Something.com.
That's cool.
And it's just a neat, interactive, multimedia website. Number 10, the last one, is a web store allows you to try and incorporate promotional products in your marketing strategy to help grow your business. So if you want to create your own line of T-shirts and caps and so forth, I mentioned one a long time ago in the top 10, but this new one is called Printfection. So P-R-I-N-T and then Fection.com. And I got the links to the Microsoft Windows 7 Service Pack Center and also the Apple press release on their new iPad, too.
Perfect.
Keep you plenty busy.
Well, let's go back to our caller earlier whose email address kind of got hijacked.
Yeah, the thing with someone hijacking your email and using your address is understanding the underlying concept of sending and receiving email is that they need to have permission to gain access through both your user account and password. And typically, that's not what is taken, but the fact that they've taken over your email system on your computer and they're leveraging that you're not realizing they're using you to send out emails on their behalf through your account. So how do you deal with that? Number one is your system obviously is still infected, so you need to get rid of the infection. So you use antivirus tools to eliminate the infection, and that typically fixes the problem. The other way to combat that is to shut down your email account temporarily. So you call up your internet service provider and ask them to, temporarily mm-hmm. put a hold on it until you call them back. You can also talk to them and see if they have spam filters and other filters that you may not realize that they have that you can start using on your account, which would also be useful. Sometimes those filters can be turned on too strong, so you need to, work with how to kind of dial them into your personal preference. For example, if someone sends emails to you and their email address is in all capitals, that may be determined by the spam filter to be spam, when in fact it isn't. It just happened to be that the person typed in their email address in all capitals, but that mm-hmm. that could be filtered out. Typically, it doesn't happen where an email is hijacked and they actually have your password to send out the emails through your account. Because if they're doing that, it's just not a typical scenario. So I would check and make sure that the system is not infected and that you're, it's not compromised.
Right.
And like I mentioned, AVG, Avast, Bitdefender, even Microsoft Security Essentials, those are all good products. Keep in mind, if you're on a network, that's a different issue with antivirus programs, because they can actually interfere with the functioning of a network environment where you're using a centralized server that has one or two maybe key programs that people are accessing the databases, or also trying to create backups so that these antivirus programs start to touch all these active files, which are actually being used by other people on the network for good things.
Yeah.
But yet the antivirus program says, hey, something's going on here. I need to touch it. I need to figure out if it's okay. That can slow things down. It can cause software to malfunction. So just be aware of that. That's a totally different issue.
On to Leslie in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hi there. I'm calling to find out the most accurate monitor for a laptop to use with digital photography. I bought a 19-inch flat screen Sharp Aquis for Christmas, mm-hmm. thinking that digital would make it sharper, but it drifts. The images go magenta or brighter or darker and wider. It's terrible. So I would like to use my SLR camera and come up with a nice big 19-inch picture that's totally accurate.
Uh-huh. Well, the key thing I would look for in a monitor is the number of pixels. The more pixels that you have in the monitor, the better image you're going to get. So I would do a search that way. I would also probably, before I pull the trigger on buying something, I would do a search on, something like CNET. You could use something like ePinions. There are some other review sites out there. So, do a search for high-res monitor for digital photography best performance. And, look at some of the posts, the feedback that people have, the comments, the reviews, because you may actually find in the bad reviews someone mentioning that they sent this back and bought something else they were looking at and were happy with what they ended up buying. So I always tell people, read the bad stuff. Don't just read the good stuff. Read the bad stuff, because when you're even not even related to the monitor, but when you're planning a trip, read the reviews of people that places that they stay and see where they would have stayed if they came back for the next time.
Yeah.
So find out the best stuff that you should be doing. So in this case, look for feedback and reviews on monitors, ones to stay away from and why, and what other people are looking for that you may not have even considered. And then go to the websites of the online retailers as well as the store ones. So you can go to BestBuy.com, but you could also go to TigerDirect.com and Buy.com, and look at the reviews from the people that have bought the ones that are being recommended and see what their feedback is. And then, you know, if it's not available in a local store and you can buy it online and you've never bought online, look for coupons for first-time buyers. You may get free shipping if shipping isn't included, but typically they're doing a lot of the free shipping. You may get a 10% or 20% off for a first-time buyer. So, you know, those are other things that can save money and get something that you actually like and will use and appreciate.
There you go. Thank you very much.
I know monitors, even though they say they're super big, I mean, I have a 26-inch screen. It doesn't have the high pixels, so it's a little blurry.
Yeah.
So
there you go. Thanks, Leslie. And Chris and Madison, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry and Peter. I have a question about cloning my memory. So if I lose the hard drive, I have a backup, and I understand with a Windows XP, I don't have anything built in. So is there a program I should download?
So you're saying
it's
like
complicated, but I guess I would go that way and pay for something if it would be worth it.
So you're talking about like completely redoing the entire hard drive?
Absolutely.
Okay. Some of these backup hard drive devices, the external ones, can actually do that, you know, create an image. Or you could buy a secondary one, and they include, you know, imaging software to do that, what you're asking.
Well, I have a hard drive, and there's no information on it on how to use it. And it has 500 gigabytes or something. It's plenty large, but
So what you're saying is you have another drive that you want to use for that purpose.
I have an external.
Yeah. You could, you know, in terms of... Personally, I'm not using anything to do that. Let's see. What I would probably do if I was looking for a program like that, I'd probably go to, you know, download.com or CNET and look at the reviews and look for something called ghosting or disk imaging. Ghosting is what you're looking for, and there are programs that are specifically written to do that.
I'm going to hang up here in a second because I have a bad connection, but you said CNET, and what's the other one? Download.
Download is a subset, but if you go on CNET, they'll typically take you to some of the reviews.
Yeah.
And then Download is their site. You could do a search for it if you know what you're looking for, but CNET is kind of like their umbrella, you know, site.
I've gone there before with some of your advice, and it's been very helpful.
Yeah, ghosting is what you're looking. They call it ghosting.
All right, good. Thanks a lot.
Yep,
thanks a lot for calling. And Joya in Fitchburg, hello to you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. Peter,
yeah.
I have a question for you. Do you know any software to protect or to install from the medical identity, you know, being stolen? Because these days, you know, they give you, the clinics tell you to go to MyChart, you know, and all the clinics in Madison or most of them. And then when you go, they have all the data of your medical information. Is there any software available to protect so it's not stolen?
Typically, when you're doing that online, you're logging into their system. So,
right.
So you're gaining partial access to your records. So it's a secure site.
It would
so
have
it's
to
real...
be on their end, not on your end.
Yeah. There's nothing stored on your system. So it's your user login and your password to gain access to that. So, you know, it's, they typically tell you, you know, pick a password that's got a capital letter, 8 or more characters, uses a combination of numbers and symbols.
So it's their system I'm going into.
Correct.
But the thing is, it's on my computer, and so, but can somebody hack it? Because I don't see any the lock sign there.
There should, when you're on their system and you've gained access, there should be in the web browser, there should be a lock, you know, yeah. It should be a closed lock when you're in.
See, or a solid the taskbar or on the menu bar or anywhere, so that's
or a solid key is another one, depends on which browser you're using. I would check with them. You know, you should probably contact them within you know, when you log in, contact them within the system, or you could probably call your provider and ask them, you know, what they're using to safeguard the information.
Yeah, I think it's pretty secure.
Yeah,
I think it'd be pretty secure.
I know it's been probably field tested for a number of years, and yeah. Probably what they're giving you access to, my guess, and I could probably talk to some of the people I know out in the field, that it's probably a subset of their entire yeah. system.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine them
no.
giving complete access to
no.
to just, you know, your records. But it would probably bog the system down with as many people gaining access to it.
Thanks, Joya. Good luck. Terry in Green Bay, on to you. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is in regards to setting up a Wi-Fi network on your computer so that you can use some of the, like, computer radio stations and things like that. I bought a Wi-Fi adapter, and I can't seem to get it to configure properly. And when I go in through the software, there's no help with that. And when I go in through to do it, it indicates there's a conflict and it can't do it.
So, when you say the Wi-Fi adapter, what do you have in your environment? In other words, you have a Wi-Fi router.
I have a Wi-Fi router in okay. my basement, and then
okay.
I bought a USB Wi-Fi adapter.
Okay.
And I have that plugged in.
And that's what you're having the problem with.
Correct.
Okay. Do you know the speed or features of your router? Is it B, G, and N, or is it? You know, is it?
It's a combination N and G.
Okay. How many antennas does it have on it? Does it have just one or three?
Just one.
Okay, and so it's the router's located in your basement.
Correct.
Where are you typically using the?
In my living room, which is, you know, physically about 20 feet away, but they're, you know, it's on the main floor instead of the basement.
Yeah. You know, that typically that can be an issue in terms of different floors and the quality of the router and how many antennas it has. How old's the router?
3 months.
Okay.
I have an iPod, you know, and that's able to access the network throughout the house.
Right. So the USB adapter is what's is it a laptop that you're using it with?
No, it's a desktop.
Desktop.
Good question. Yeah.
Well, no, it's just that, you know, it's a matter of, you know, they have cards and you can plug them into the outlets, and they're I found them to be more reliable than the USBs. My recommendation, and you're saying you just purchased this, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. I would probably call the manufacturer. They offer support, and they may have certain things for you to try to test it to see if it's actually working. The thing, and I've mentioned this over the years, the thing that we try to accept at face value is that everything that we buy brand new out of the box is perfect, and in fact...
Maybe
it could
not.
It could have an issue not only in the device itself, but the device may be fine, but it may have a compatibility issue with your system.
Okay.
So that's a possibility. I had a Wi-Fi adapter in a laptop, and I was trying to set it up in my living room, and I know the Wi-Fi worked because I had always used it, and it wouldn't work. And to make a long story short, and I've told this story numerous times over the years, I called in the manufacturer for support, and they said, well, you must have a worm virus. And I said, how do I have a worm virus? I'm trying to hook it up to the internet, but I can't. Where did the worm virus come from? And they hung up the phone on me. So then I called back, and I explained what happened, and that, you know, the phone, they hung up the phone on me. Trust me, they hung it up because that was like the stand pat answer. And the second person said, well, you have to have a worm virus. And I said, so you're telling me out of the box, you're shipping a brand new laptop from the factory with a worm virus. I mean, that's the only way it could have gotten on it, because that's all I've done with it.
What did he say to
point,
that?
My point is, I ended up finding out that the OEM, the original equipment manufacturer of the Broadcom Wi-Fi device in the laptop, had a bad device driver that was installed in the at the factory, and I had to update it in order to get it work with Wi-Fi. So accepting face value that things are brand new, out of the box, they work with everything that we try to attach, is no. Why you should call the manufacturer and ask them to help you work through the setup and try and attempt to get it to work. And it may be an incompatibility issue. I've had it where they didn't have the right device driver for it because the operating system had changed and I was trying to use it with a newer version of Windows and they didn't support it. So they said, you know, return it. It's not going to work.
Nah.
So
there you go.
What version of the operating system are you using on the desktop?
I'm running XP.
XP? Did you install with XP device drivers?
Yes.
There may be some incompatibility issue that may exist. You know, that's why I would just check with the manufacturer. They probably have a whole bingo sheet to go through with you, you know, to test and just make sure. And it could be location, you know, just, you know, in terms of where that antenna, maybe it's getting roadblocked by something where your desktop is located.
Yeah,
so
it could be that. Just try move it around a bit and try it.
Yeah, but you see, desktops are kind of a pain to move around.
Yeah,
but
they are.
But I'm just saying that, you know, since it's brand new, the manufacturer is a good place to start with. They offer free support on it, and hopefully they'll get you a good answer.
Wow. Thank you very much for calling, Terry. Virtually all of our lines are filled, and there's a whole string of emails.
We could stay on all afternoon.
We could be on all afternoon, Pete. Oh,
we should have a marathon, Larry.
Tell you what, come back in a month and we'll talk about that.
sounds like a plan.
Peter Green of InfoStar, our Madison, our guest today. And I'm sorry we didn't, obviously we never get to everybody but when he's on, but we'll do our best. And take a look at his website, InfoStar.com, for all the latest information. Thank you for listening. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk joins us tomorrow on the Ideas Network.